Station number 14252.
Mr. Perkins, Rail 2, what impression did the Canadians make on you?
A good impression. A very, very good impression. We knew them to be coming from famous regiments, like the Regina Rifles, the Chaudière Regiment, the Royal Winnipeg Rifles, the Queen's Own Regiment of Canada. They were all very, very good regiments, and we knew that they were going to do a very good job, as they did, or tried to do, in Dieppe landings, which we learnt a lot from, actually, the Dieppe landings. The Canadians took a heavy toll of casualties at Dieppe, and we knew that they were going to give a good account of themselves in Normandy.
Now, do you remember your briefing that you had for D-Day?
Yes, we went to, I think they were drill halls that were set up, closely guarded, very closely guarded, where we learnt all the places off sand tables. All the beach areas, all the targets, all the pillboxes were all laid out that we could expect to see. Certain houses that we would expect to see were all there very prominently on the details of the sand maps. Photographs, aerial photographs were taken and displayed for us, and it was all went through battalion briefings. And yes, they did really put us in the picture as to where we were going, but none of the places were named. Only in code. So we couldn't tell really where it was. And all these places were gathered together by a series, thousands and thousands of postcards that were sent in by the public. When there was an appeal made of where did you spend your holiday in France, could we have your postcards, and thousands turned up at the war office. And from that, they picked the ideal spots to land. But on the sand table maps, they were all coded. One or two of the men knew where it was because they'd been there on holiday before, but they didn't really let on. They could have taken bets on it, but they didn't. They did not. They rather left it as it was, because they would have been in prison if they'd have let the cat out of the bag where these particular villages were. And they were all coded. All the major villages along the seafront of Normandy were all coded. Could have been anything. I can't remember offhand what some of them were, but it could have been anything.
And then, can you take me through the lead-up to the landing itself?
The lead-up? Well, yes, we began to be more intensive with our training landings. Wet landings every other day, you know, and really wet landings. A 4-foot wade in ashore. And that began to intensify towards the end of May, before the end of May, middle of May, I suppose. One practice scheme after another were coming up. And we knew that we were getting pretty near this because we'd go out fully armed with everything. So we knew we were getting near it. And then prior to that, in about April, we were behind barbed wire. Everybody was behind barbed wire. Security was so tight. If a man was seen on a station, that was it. He was running, if he didn't have the appropriate passes. Civilian population were controlled by passes for a 10-mile area outside the beach areas, of loading areas. 10 mile back, there was interrogation of anybody walking using the areas, had to have all the appropriate passes, thousands of red caps around, and the NAFI, all the NAFIs came into the camps, barbed wire around all the camps, you couldn't get out of the camps, you were not allowed out anywhere. Everything was in the camps, barbers, everything. We knew that was it. That was the nail in the coffin for us, really. The fact was, we knew we were on top security, and it was imminent. What made it even more imminent was they decided to get rid of the caps we wore. We used to have forage caps. They got rid of the forage cap and gave us a beret, a khaki beret. They said, this stays on your head better when you're running. And they were absolutely right. And it, they looked hideous. When we were first issued with them, they looked absolutely hideous as a military headdress. Then, leading up to D-Day itself, possibly 2 weeks before, we had what they call the Normandy haircut. That was all off the head, hair taken right off to within a quarter of an inch all over. Something like a crew cut. This was to prevent the spread of lice, where you couldn't wash, all that kind of thing. So we went to the barbers and we looked a sight. Everybody was shorn off, like shearing sheep.
And did you have any visits by any VIPs?
Yes, we did. We were inspected first by, well, not inspection really. He came to visit the battalion, Montgomery. He drove into this area near Bournemouth. We were training then. We were stationed in Westbourne Avenue. And he came into the a football field, and the jeep stopped in the middle. And he got up on the jeep and he said, everybody gather round me. And in the stampede to get to the front, I lost my cap and had to go back for it, so I was at the back of the parade. Could just hear what he was saying, really, and he gave us a fairly good speech that he was going to rely on us to do and finish the job in Europe. And then he made off. And then the whole 3rd Canadian Division, with us as well, were inspected by the King in Bournemouth again, and that was a more a parade where he went down through the ranks, the King. He walked down through all the ranks. Didn't take too long, and he was in the car and gone. And then a little while after that, Eisenhower came, and that took the format of a march past, just a march past, and he took the salute. Really, he didn't have a speech; he just took the march past, and that was the visits of the three heads of state, really, or the three people concerned.
What effect did Montgomery's speech have on you?
Oh yes, very impressed by him. Yes, the mere fact that you've met Monty did a lot to boost the morale. I mean, he had a great reputation in the desert and in Italy, and we hadn't seen this man. We hadn't been in action. Neither had the 3rd Canadian Division been in action. Someone might have done through Dieppe, but basically they were pretty green, the same as we were. And to be spoken to by Montgomery was quite something, really. We were pleased to have that reassuring speech.
How confident were you when you actually embarked?
Well, we moved from the last transit area in Creechwalk Camp in Waterlooville. We moved then down to the Southampton city centre. There are gardens in the city centre now, beautiful gardens, as you know now, perhaps. And that was ringed with barbed wire. And we moved down into there first in one day on transports, and we were put in the barbed wire and prior to loading. And our disposal point for loading was the 101 dock, which was called the new dock, Southampton. And in that docks, it must have went back 3 miles, I suppose, and it was nothing but landing craft tied to the jetty, 7 or 8 deep, all the way along to the jetty. A vast, just unimaginable sight to see all these landing craft. And then the buzz got round, it's on. So we were marched down right through the city centre in 3 ranks, fully equipped, camouflage netting, you know, to really to make this landing. All the equipment, all the ammunition that we had to carry, the Bren, I was a Bren gunner myself. And we moved down to the dock area and we were put on, we had to walk from one landing craft to the other, to the other, to the other, to load. And we then pushed off out to sea through Southampton waters, and the storm came up. This is 2 days before the landing started. And the storm came up and we anchored off Calshot Spit. We could not have anchored in a worse place. Right on the end of the flying boat base at Calshot. It was the seas were horrendous there in the Solent. I'd never seen the Solent so terrible, really. We weren't used to this kind of sea. And we waited there till the night of the 5th. And then Eisenhower said, we go in the morning. So that night we pushed off out to sea to the areas where we designated to go, which was termed Piccadilly Circus, and then on into the beaches.
What was your actual crossing like?
It was a very, very bad crossing. Besides being 2 days anchored in terrible seas, we had this terrible sea on the night of D-Day as well. It was most unpleasant. We were all seasick. We were in a bad state, really. Even the sailors were damn sick. I've never seen sailors sick like that. They were not used to it either. And it was something we just had to put up with, I suppose. People were not eating. They were certainly not sleeping. So when we arrived on the morning of the beach landing on the June the 6th, we were not in a very good state, really.
What was the name of the ship that took you?
I can't remember. It was an LCT, and we transferred then to a small craft. I can't remember the name of the ship. They were all numbered, you see.
How was the transfer done?
Just by going off, dropping the lamp on sea level and walking off the ramp into another boat, tied up alongside. And we transferred that way, using the ramp.
From the side of the ship?
Yeah, yeah. The small craft come up to the ramp, tied up, and then we loaded and then pushed off.
Were there any mishaps in transfer?
Not too many, not that I noticed, no. You had to remember that we had this vast amount of equipment because a beach group, we didn't land with the assault with small, what they call battle order. We had field marching order, which was a big pack, small pack, everything. Blanket tied round, blanket tied in a ground sheet, and then tied round the top of the big pack, going right round the pack. And all the clothes in the pack, all their spare clothing, socks, pants, vest, all that kind of thing, and a great coat, all that kind of things was wrapped in the gas cape and pushed down into the big pack very tight. And that became buoyant then. It was acted as a life jacket to us, really, and we all had May Wests as well. And that was it. Loading was extremely difficult with all this equipment because one got jostled. And but then we were told on the way over that the landing was in the morning. This was the real thing. We knew that anyway because we've gone so far out to sea. It can only be halfway channel, more than halfway across when we were told, into Piccadilly Circus. And then off to our respective beach areas, you know, Juneau, Sword, Gold, Omaha, Utah, the Americans. So we were on our way. And we thought, good, let's get the job done. Let's get on terra firma. We were so ill. Let's get on hard on shore. And I thought, I think most of us thought, if anything happened to us, we'd rather be on dry land than on this raging sea.
What did you see when dawn broke?
Well, when dawn broke, of course, the barrage started. We were due to land about 7:30 in the morning. But that was delayed a quarter of an hour because the last-minute aerial photographs spotted on the Canadian sector on Juno, what they thought were rocks in the sea on the shore. And they said, well, we'll delay the opening for a quarter of an hour so that the boats, the assault boats, can go in over the top of the rocks with a higher tide, so that we sailed in over the top. But when we got there, we found all it was kelp, seaweed. So they could have put the landing forward. But on our left, as we approached the beach area, there was all hell let loose on Sword Beach, which was the landing was up our 6. So the time we got to Juno, the Germans were aware that something big was happening. And that didn't take much calculation because there were thousands of ships out there in front of him. You can't imagine how many ships were there. You couldn't have got any more in. There were so many ships, and they were all moving in to do specific things. You know, the corvettes, the destroyers, the landing ship rockets were all starting the bombardment. And the bombardment was absolutely colossal. Great warships. My uncle's warship, the Warspite, was there. He was on the Warspite on the Normandy landings, and he was actually firing over the top as if we went in, which was hard to believe, wasn't it, really? And we did this. As we ran in, I should think we transferred about 7,000 yards out into another craft. As we ran in, the whole seashore looked like a blue haze. He was smoke shells, shells bursting, and smoke shells as well to cover the landing in. And it looked pretty hectic, actually, coming in under this barrage. Thousands of shells whizzing over the top as one was coming in. And the din was absolutely enormous, indescribable. All types of craft were firing. Even the landing craft that was coming in with tanks on board were firing their guns actually in the landing craft to help with the bombardment, or targets that they could see that it could hit, you know. And eventually we approached the seashore and we got in very close, and suddenly we were grounded and we were off. So everybody off, and down went the ramp, and it was a mad dash for the sand dunes. Waves of Canadians had already gone in before us. Royal Winnipeg Rifles on our particular beach, they were Royal Winnipeg Rifles. And when we got there, there were a lot of dead Canadians laying about the beach areas. One of their companies in particular were advancing when they hit the beach. There's all the beach obstacles were blowing up around them, and landing craft were blowing up, hitting the mine obstructions on the beach, and the Winnipeg Rifles got caught with crossfire by machine guns as they were advancing up a groin that was running out to sea. And they were trying to shelter behind the groin as they came up, but they got caught in crossfire, and they lost the majority of one of that companies. And they laid there. It was terrible to see, really. And some of our chaps were injured too. We didn't suffer too many casualties ourselves. Enough, you know, but not too many, which was good, really. But the Canadian, the town of Bernières that we landed at, it was not until 2 o'clock in the afternoon that town became clear enough to say, look, okay, let's get on with the rest of the landing. Let's start taking all the second waves and the follow-up troops and the stores. Started to come in the next day. So as soon as we got on shore, we had to make sure that we could dig in, check the air out for mines, because along that coastal line, there was 4 million mines of all types in the sand dunes everywhere. So the flail's done a lot of it. The flail's done all the beach exits out. They cleared that double width so that we could move a bit more and get two tracks up, one track into the beach, one track out. And even the bivvy areas were mined, where we dropped down to dig in first, and we had to make sure that there was no mines in their bivvy area, and we had to probe for our own mines. Some found some didn't. And we dug these hurried bolt holes in the sand, and we got into there initially and set up gun positions, anti-tank positions, mortar positions, because we were being mortared at the same time, and sniped at as well, especially. Sniping went on all day. Sniping from a church by what was supposed to be a woman was sniping at duck drivers as they were coming up the beach. And she was picking off duck drivers in different periods through the day, and until they decided to knock the church tower off with a Bofors gun. And that put pay to that.
What made you think it was a woman?
Well, they said it was a woman afterwards. Yeah. A girlfriend of a German soldier. He left her there with his uniform and his rifle. Yeah. He's probably taken prisoner, I expect. But it did happen. It did happen out there. There was, when I got onto the beach first, the sergeant said, come on, we better get all these dead off the beach. And we formed a beach body recovery party, and we went picking up bodies lying about the beach area, because we knew very well that the tanks were coming in all the time. They could not leave these bodies about the beach because they were going to get run over. They were in the way, of course, and it wasn't very a pretty sight to see these men killed, gone a few yards and dropped down. And the incoming troops that were coming in wouldn't like to have seen that happening, and so we decided to get these people off the beach areas and lay them up on the sand dunes and cover them over. And eventually, you know, we took all their particulars off them and documented them and put tags on them, and then they were buried in shallow graves. And there was 100 and some odd of the Royal Winnipeg Rifles. The total casualties of the Canadian sector on D morning was about 1,050 dead. Similarly, on Sword, it was about 1,000 again. And on the other one, on Gold, at Aramont, that was another 1,000. So on the British land, it was about 3,000 dead that first morning, which it was they expected far more casualties than that, really.
How did you feel by now?
Well, we got over our seasickness. I think being aware of this acute problem of shells coming in and mortars coming in and sniper fire, I think that put our mind on a different track about worrying about our seasickness. And it was then a question of getting as deep as we could underground for our own survival, really, and then start doing the jobs that we were designated to do. Yeah.
Did you do anything else before nightfall, before you slept?
Yes, we had our platoon was singled out to take out a very large pillbox that the Canadians left. There were all sorts of pockets of resistance that were left, and the battalion had to winkle those out of their positions. And we sort of roamed the beach areas, looking out for what we could find, you know, and if there was a question of a fire coming from a certain area, we'd go and investigate it and put it out of action. And one particular heavy pillbox that was taken out by members of my section, I wasn't involved myself, but my section went with my lieutenant, and he was awarded the MM for taking out a very large pillbox.
But you yourself weren't in any of this infantry work?
Oh yes, very much so, yeah. Yeah, because the next day then, of course, all this stuff started coming in, pouring in. Then we started our normal role of unloading everything.
How did you feel the Germans fought on the beaches at D-Day?
Well, there were a lot of youngsters. We captured a lot of youngsters there, and there were some SS. But not too many. They were a mixed bag of people, really. And there was quite a few prisoners. And they came along to our beach area too, because we had another role to do. All the wounded then had to be put on Landingcraft and taken back to England. So we would stretcher these chaps off onto Landingcraft, lay them all out on the decks of Landingcraft, plus German prisoners. So we had to load them all on Landingcraft. So loading off and loading on. Right beside actually where I was dug in on this particular beach at Berniers, just to the right of the town, there was a major first aid post, a rather large one. And a friend of mine was in another section of the Royal Army Medical Corps, and he was about a mile from me in the little chateau where they set up an operations unit operating on wounded soldiers. Still within the Juno beach area and still with the number 8 beach group attached to us.
How were the German prisoners treated?
Well, we didn't give them a lot to eat on the first day. We gave them some work to do. We gave them jobs like digging holes for burial. And then we used them too for help and get some of the wounded up off the beach as well. And then we used them to get some of the obstacles out of the way.
Were any of the German prisoners beaten or shot?
No, I don't think so, no. No. Some of them were too young, really. Some were very young.
What was the attitude of the POWs? Was it, were they cowed or were they arrogant?
No, some were. Very few were arrogant. The SS type were arrogant. But the others were just an ordinary infantry units, really. The Wehrmacht, sent there just as we were doing in Suffolk, really, as a beach defence unit. And when it was over for them. They were prisoners, and I think they accepted it as that. Well, they just had to, didn't they, really?
Can you tell me about what happened to you in the rest of Normandy as you pushed inland?
Well, we stayed in that particular area for 11 weeks, doing nothing but unload stores, bridging, acetylene bottles for the Remy, taking Dannet wire off of boats, masses of Dannet wire, all kinds of equipment for war, all kinds. Blankets, nurses come ashore. We thought we'd help them ashore by giving them a piggyback ride, but that was none. They wanted to wade ashore, so they waded ashore. They came a long way and they said, we're going to wade ashore. during that landing, my regiment alone, one talks of the Mulberry Harbour being such a marvellous thing, but people have to remember that the Mulberry Harbour didn't actually start working until D plus 17 days. 17 days. So that meant the entire British Army and the entire Canadian Army on both all sectors had to be supplied by beach groups handling this stuff manhandled over the beach. Everything was manhandled. If you had to load it into a net in the hold of a ship, it was still used by the bare hands. My battalion amassed a sum of 11 weeks